For you guys on Zoom, the picture that you're seeing is of Chris and Steve in front of the volunteer fire department's photos, as we meet in the volunteer fire department when there are meetings going on in the meeting room of the house. And I'm going to give Chris a moment to introduce Steve, and we'll get going here in just a moment. It's 7:28, so let's get started.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. I am really excited to be here with my friend Steve. A little bit about me. Grace of God separated me from alcohol somewhere around December 28th, 1989. It was a period of hazy recollections and hallucinations and all kinds of other stuff. So I'm not particularly sure about the date, but that's the one I claim anyway. I discovered the Wilson House in the mid-90s. We were just driving through on a vacation, and I remember pulling in. I remember walking in there, and I remember saying, I'm going to come back here. You know, there's just something about it. I know I'm not the only one. And so we started to do some workshops over the years. We've had some really, really fun ones. And I'm absolutely looking forward to having our friend Steve from Nashville join us. So thank you so much for making the trip up, Steve.
Well, thank you, Chris. Good evening, everyone. I'm Steve Lee. I'm an alcoholic. I'm thrilled to be here. This is just such a treat for me to both be at the Wilson House, but to be with you guys. And it dawns on me that we going to have to make a decision here pretty quickly, right? We're pretty adaptable people, and as a group, we got to decide whether we're going to get all the way in this thing and be present despite some of the distractions and things that we're having to do to accommodate a good judgment and good health. And so, but you know, that's not hard. That shouldn't be hard for folks like us. We're resistant sometimes, and I'm certainly one of those folks. But gosh, we have faced so much already to get here. The things I'll start complaining about after I get sober are pretty remarkable. You know, I literally got one of my best friend's daughters this past week, helped her get in treatment. And he went and got her from her apartment. And in her apartment, there was nothing in the room but a blow-up mattress. When he dropped her off at treatment and went back and tried to negotiate his way out of the lease and stuff that was there, he had to buy a refrigerator. Because there were maggots in the refrigerator. And then I went out to visit her at the treatment facility and she complained about the food being cold. That's who we are, right? But, so I'm riding home with you guys. I'm thrilled to be here. I see it as just such a wonderful opportunity for me to, you know, be in it with a group of people and connect over the course of this next 2.5 days, whatever we've got, and have a conversation. Chris and I talk. We hope during the course of the weekend we're going to have an ask it basket and invite some questions and stuff. But I'm just excited to be here. My sobriety date's June 30th, 1989, and I am from Nashville. And my home group is the Recovery on the Road group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Historic Music Row in Nashville, so I hope you'll come see us if you get there. And a lot of people do get a chance to visit. So it's not an idle invitation. Please get my information before I leave and call me if you come to town. But I'm excited to hang out with you guys and to be with my friend Chris. I'm grateful he invited me, and we'll see what happens. We spent countless seconds trying to figure out how we were going to conduct ourselves the balance of the weekend, and we've come up with a plan that couldn't possibly go wrong. And so I'll give it back to Chris to get us started tonight.
Thanks, Steve. So, you know, what we talked about in the first couple of seconds was what we were going to do in this first session. And, you know, the decision was basically, we want to qualify. We want to make sure that we've convinced you, you know, that we're alcoholic and we belong, in this recovery fellowship and, with all of you. And we'll do that. But really also to talk about how we fully embrace the concept of step one. How do we fully concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholic? And how did we understand alcoholism? What material did we need to go through to understand what alcoholism was? And you know, I'll start. I started drinking somewhere around 1969, 1970. And I, from the get-go, had a different relationship with alcohol than a lot of the guys that I was drinking with. The first thing that was apparent was when I started drinking, guess what? If there was alcohol available, I kept drinking it. Unless I was somehow separated from it, I kept drinking it. And that's problematic, in itself. But I didn't recognize it as a huge problem. I basically would have told you, I party, man. You know? Like, what are you, a lightweight? I party. So my perception on the craving for alcohol right off the get-go was delusional. I tried to hang out with people who drank like me, you know, like John over here. He was just like me. So when we drank together, there was no sore thumbs sticking out, you know, we would do the same thing. So I started drinking early on and, you know, a lot of it was in fields or in people's houses with their parents weren't home. But once I started to take my drinking out on the road, I started to really suffer some consequences. I immediately started crashing cars, and ending up in hospitals and having people come up to me the next day at school and say things like this: "Do you know what you did last night?" And I'm like, "No, you know, I don't remember any of that." You know, it got to the point where I told them, "Just don't tell me." You know, whatever it was, just don't tell me, because it was usually, it became more and more tragic and pathetic, you know, my behavior. But you know, over the course of time, I started to adapt my life and adapt my belief systems to massive amounts of alcohol. I had to normalize it somehow. Now, the milkman would have noticed that I was drinking too much. The neighbors all knew I drank too much. But if you were to come up to me and say, "Chris, you drink too much," you know, I would probably say, "I don't drink enough." You know, I don't, where do you get that? It's none of your business how I drink. And I would cut that individual out of my life. You know, I would distance myself from anyone who was, you know, raising a red flag on me. And so it got to the point where, you know, most of the people I was paying attention to were deeply involved in alcoholism or drug addiction or something, or dysfunctional or crazy. And that's kind of where I slowly ended up. Now alcoholism can be like an evolution. You know, over any considerable period of time, it can get worse, it can change, we can get more and more deluded, we can face more and more consequences, and we, you know, we can become better at telling ourselves lies about this alcoholism. But probably for the first 10 years of my drinking, there were periods of time in that drinking where I was having a lot of fun. I mean, I was going to the high school parties and getting really drunk, or going, we lived right outside of New York City, so we were going and see the best rock bands in the world, you know, in the 1970s. You know, one weekend it'd be Led Zeppelin, you know, the next weekend it'd be Pink Floyd, then it'd be the Grateful Dead, and we would just go in and we would party and just, you know, somehow find our way home. And it all kind of seemed fun in the first 10 years. Like when I look back on it, I'm thinking, oh my God, I ruined all those experiences being in a blackout. I ruined all those experiences being so high, I have no memory of them. You know, but during that period of time, I really believed that I needed those substances to make the whole thing work. Now, because alcoholism is progressive and it really starts to, how the progression looked in my case basically was over any given period of time, I was putting more ounces of alcohol in my body per week. If there was a graph of alcohol consumption per month, you know, it was going like this. And, you know, when that happens, you end up doing a lot of drunk stuff. You end up, getting into a lot of trouble. And a lot of things happened in those first 10 years. A lot of DUIs, a lot of hospital stays. And then there was like a turn somewhere around my 10th year of drinking where it became isolation drinking. Like it became very dangerous for me to go out and drink at bars. It became very dangerous for me to go out, you know, because I'd be driving or something, right? So probably the last 10 years of my drinking were, it was basically in isolation, you know, drinking by myself in a room. And by this time, alcohol had become such a master of my life that my life would look like this. I would come to in the morning wearing the clothes that I had passed out in the night before. I'd stagger into the bathroom. You know, I was a non-filter cigarette smoker, so I'd have to do a bunch of vomiting when I first got up. You know, so I'd get my vomiting over with, and then I'd brush my teeth, and I'd go out to my $100 car, and I'd go off to a really terrible, you know, terrible job with a terrible boss, and I'd be completely shattered, just absolutely completely shattered. And there were times when I would basically swear, "This is it. I'm done. I'm done. I don't want to feel this bad anymore." Do you remember what it's like? You know, when you come into the next day and saying, "I never want to feel this bad again." Well, that happened to me for years. And what would happen is I'd go off to my terrible job and somewhere around 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, after swearing off alcohol, I'd start to think, maybe that decision was an overreaction. You know? To quit drinking, like, forever? You know, that seems very reactionary. And what would happen is I would change my mind by quitting time, and right from leaving work, I would hit the liquor store, and I would buy a quart of vodka or a quart of bourbon, and I'd take it back to the house, and I'd pour it into a giant glass with ice. I had these like 60-ounce glasses, and I'd put about halfway up in ice, and I'd fill them up to about an inch from the top with bourbon or vodka. And if it was vodka, I'd put some orange juice. If it was bourbon, I'd put some Coca-Cola. And literally, there'd be about 30 shots in each of these glasses. And I'd start drinking. And it all seemed normal. You know, I had sworn off alcohol that morning, and I meant it. And I'm drunk as a hoot owl by 6 o'clock at night on a work night every single time. And then the weekend would come, and what the weekend would look like was I would get drunk on Friday night. I'd come to sometime, you know, or sometime Saturday morning, and I'd start drinking. I'd go right to drinking, and I'd go into a blackout and I'd pass out. And when I came to, I'd start drinking again, and I could get drunk 4 or 5 times in a 2-day period doing that, just like full-time blackout drinking. And it just, I don't know if it's really accurate to say it felt like this was normal, but it was normal for me to do this. And it was chewing me up. It was chewing me up. So I tried, I had to go to an outpatient IOP in 1983 to get one of my driver's licenses back. And what it was a bunch of people sitting around in group talking about how they felt. And I had absolutely no clue what that had anything to do with me. You know what I mean? I hated everybody in this group, and it was just a bunch of crap. And I just did it to get my ticket so I could get my license back. But one thing I learned was somebody said, dude, man, you know, the real hardcore people, they're up on the fifth and sixth floor of the hospital. They put you inpatient. It's locked down, dude. You know, so I had in the back of my mind since 82 or something that there was a lockdown ward for alcoholism. So my drinking gets worse and worse and worse. And I start to become violent and I start to become crazy. And, I end up one day just giving up, just saying, I don't know what it is about alcohol, but I'm drinking it every day. Maybe if I go to this 28-day treatment center, they'll teach me how to not drink every day. I didn't know anything. So I signed myself into a 28-day, treatment center and I went through it. I participated as best I could. It was not a pretty sight. I get out of the treatment center and I stayed sober a couple of months. And what happened was one day on the way to an AA meeting, the thought crossed my mind that I haven't been drunk in almost 3 months. Matter of fact, I don't even remember what it's like to feel drunk. I think what I should do is I should buy a gallon of vodka. And if I buy this gallon of vodka and I drink it, it'll remind me what it's like. I'll feel really bad the next day and I'll shoot back to this AA thing and really start to do a good job with it. And that's what I did. I bought a gallon of vodka to improve my sobriety. And I know there's people here that get that. That's why we like each other. We're all crazy. So what happened was it started a 7 month debacle of the worst drinking and the worst emotional and spiritual, agony I think I've ever experienced. And when the smoke cleared from that, I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous with an absolute vengeance, just an absolute vengeance, willing to do all the stupid things like, oh, get a sponsor. Oh, yeah. That's not going to work in my case. Get a home group. Oh, yeah. Well, I know why most people would get a home group, but that's not going to work in my case. I got willing to do all the things that I wasn't doing and I plugged in to the fellowship, but I still didn't know what alcoholism was. I knew that I drank too much. I knew I was addicted to alcohol. I knew I was caught up in a terrible lifestyle, but I didn't know what alcoholism was. And then somebody handed me a set of 90-minute tapes, cassette tapes, and it was a big book workshop. And it was the first time I ever heard an accurate representation of step one, what I was suffering from. I was suffering from the phenomenon of craving when alcohol goes in my body, and how that presented in me was the first drink always wanted the second insisted on the third demanded the fourth, and I wanted the 16th drink more than I wanted the 15th. And that's a physiological, spiritual, mental conundrum. There was no fight in me against that. And that one was pretty easy to understand, but the second part was really hard. That I was susceptible to an obsession that would override all other thoughts and convince me to buy a gallon of vodka to improve my sobriety. You know what I'm talking about? Like that's the obsession of the mind. Alcohol doesn't care how it gets back in your body. In an unrecovered, unprotected state. So I started to learn a little bit about that. And then there was the after the dash, that I was an absolutely awful manager of my life. If you looked at how I lived my life, the belief systems I had, the decisions I was making, the relationships I was in, there's no way you couldn't have given me an F minus. And I really started to look at that and I started to dig into the text, Alcoholics Anonymous, which just gives a beautiful series of examples of step one. Fred, Jim, the man of 30, And I started to get it. I started to get just how much trouble I was in and what I was up against. And, I want to pass it over to my friend, Steve. Steve.
Oh, thank you, Chris. I had no idea he was that bad. I would never have come up here if I'd have known that. Man, you know what Chris was talking about so much and what I was encouraged to do when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to Alcoholics Anonymous through a treatment center that I was in under duress and to fulfill, my obligation to the legal system of Williamson County, Tennessee for the conviction of my 6th DUI a year before. And we'd done some plea bargain stuff and I got some jail time and they cut some of that down if I would go to treatment. But I had no intention of stopping drinking. And, you know, over the course of the next, again, day and a half, 2 days, whatever we got here, however you count those hours, you'll hear my story, but it will not be in order. And it will be in a series of seemingly unrelated stories that I hope by the time I get on a plane Sunday, you'll forgive me for. But you'll know me better. You'll know at least what my life has been like. But the first thing they did when I got to that treatment facility was decide that they wanted to explore my relationship with alcohol. And when I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys encourage me to explore my relationship with alcohol, but you do that by telling me about your relationship with alcohol. You don't quiz me about my drinking. You share about yours and give me that opportunity for identification, which is the linchpin of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's what got me here. It's what keeps me here. The identification today is less with the problem and more with the solution, but it still is what we have in common and keeps me here. But man, all the stuff that Chris talked about is stuff I didn't know either. You know, there's a great line in our book, back in A Vision for You, talking about Dr. Bob. And it says, that he was painfully aware of being somehow abnormal, for he did not yet fully understand what it meant to be alcoholic. And I sure spent a lot of time painfully aware I was somehow abnormal, but I could not have explained or articulated to you what the abnormality was. And I got here because I had alcohol-related problems, which is different than being alcoholic, but I could connect the dots between my drinking and the trouble I got into as a result of my drinking. I tell you something, at least in my case, you cannot get a DUI if you have not been drinking. Now, I did go to a beginner's meeting in Nashville, a full moon group on Friday nights, and I went back into beginner's meeting. I love it. And this guy sat down next to me, and I could tell he was not happy to be in this meeting. And I get that. He had his arm in a sling, you know. We show up sometimes in actual bandages. But I said, "Hey, what brings you here tonight, man?" And he grunted. He said, "I got a DUI for having a broken tail light." I said, "You know, brother, I don't usually call BS right out of the gate, but, I said, that's not true. I said, you got pulled over for having a broken tail light. You got a DUI for being drunk." And I was drunk in all of mine, so I could connect those dots. And I didn't spend as much time trying to stop drinking as Chris did. I spent a lot of time trying to not let that happen again. Whatever that was. Because looks like the way to navigate this is to try harder to do better. It looks like that if I would really put my mind to it, that I'll be able to navigate this, because I didn't want to quit drinking. I wanted to quit getting DUIs. I never got one on purpose. I never at the beginning of the evening, you know, I took the top off of that, up that bottle and said, "You know, if I do everything just right, by around 12 or 1 o'clock tonight, I will have cheated on my wife, wrecked my car, pissed my pants, be handcuffed in the back of a police car, you know, on the way, let's get that party started, you know." Never was that my plan, but that some version of that happened multiple times. And I don't get it, right? There's another, for me, great passage in our book, and it's back in to the employer. And I know I'm with some committed AA members here this weekend, but you got to be full on committed to read all the way to the employer. Those pages aren't dog-eared in your book, I know. But back in there, it says when dealing with an alcoholic, there may be a natural annoyance that someone could be so weak, stupid, and irresponsible. That's coming from the point of view of the employer who is uninformed about alcoholism, and to the untrained eye, alcoholism looks weak, stupid, and irresponsible. It looks like to those around me, if you loved me, you wouldn't do that. If you cared about your daughter, Steve, you wouldn't be drunk at the hospital when she was born. If you cared about this job, you'd show up and do it. You know, if you wouldn't do that if you cared enough. Don't you see? And they would give me good information. We all got a lot of good information before we got here, accurate information. But logic, good intentions, and firm resolve proved to be no match for alcoholism, but I didn't get it. So not only did the people around me think I was weak, stupid, and irresponsible, I thought I was weak, stupid, and irresponsible. Now, I didn't say it out loud to them. You're defending yourself from the charges from other people, but alone, with myself and with my thoughts, what's the matter? I was painfully aware of being somehow abnormal, but I didn't get it. Also, couldn't wrap my head around the idea that I had alcoholism when I wasn't drinking. How can I have this thing called alcoholism if there's no alcohol involved? Now, at the front end, I've got to examine that relationship, and I had the one that Chris talked about. It looks a little different on different ones of us. When I got to AA, and you guys began to share your stories with me, when you began to talk about your alcoholism, and I began to read about it in our book, you gave voice to my alcoholism. You gave me a language to talk about it in. You would say something, and the moment after you said it, I would know that had been true about me forever. The moment before you said it, I had no idea. Then you said it, and it resonated with me. I'll tell you what I believe that is. I've come to believe that's the language of the heart. And the language of the heart isn't just kind, sweet, you know, heart music playing in the background. The language of the heart resonates somewhere other than intellectual. It's not the information. It lands somewhere inside. It hits me in that spiritual malady. It hits me in a place of knowing and feeling rather than being academic and intellectual. And I would have a feeling about this. And you gave me this language. I'm like, you know, I was never in a bar and after about my third drink, you know, nudged the guy next to me and said, "I don't know about you, pal, but that phenomenon of craving's kicking in on me." Whoa, lack of power is my dilemma. I didn't have that kind of language. I just felt like I changed my mind. I was going to go, you know, and that was usually about not how much I drank. It was usually about, you know, needing to be somewhere I didn't get to, you know. I tell my wife last year, I said, "Baby, I'll be home at 7. She says, "You're going to have to be more specific." You know, AM or PM, and Tuesday or Thursday, August or September. And I'm kidding, but I'm not kidding. And I meant it when I said it. And the thing that was so baffling was how often I said, "Baby, I'm going to be home at 7, and I was home at 7. And then the next time I was, circumstances weren't any different. My intentions weren't any different. My resolve was just as committed. And it didn't feel like, it just all of a sudden after that third, fourth, fifth drink, whatever it is, I just thought, well, I'm a grown man. I'm working. I don't have to go home. Nobody can tell me what to do. Or nothing. Or I just went off into what our book says, oblivion. Awakening to face the hideous four horsemen of terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Often it wasn't a choice. Sometimes I suffered the delusion that it was a choice, like Chris talked about. But I don't understand this relationship I have to alcohol. They asked me questions when I showed up at that treatment facility that morning. And you know, that was 1989, and it felt like a test, but I know it was an assessment now in the language of treatment. And I did a psychosocial workup that had a lot of clinical questions, but they also had 30 questions that were a little bit like Jeff Foxworthy's "You Might Be a Redneck" is. And they all began with the phrase, "Have you ever?" Boy, that's very little wiggle room in that. Have you ever? And they explained that that meant even once and even with a really good reason. Have you ever drank in the morning? Have you ever drank alone? Have you ever had a blackout? Have you ever had a DUI? Have you ever had trouble at work because of drinking? Have you ever had trouble at home because of drinking? 30 have you ever questions, which most of you know, just have check yes or check no, to what I contend are clearly essay questions. These are questions that beg for an explanation. And you know, we laugh here tonight. I can even see you laughing behind your mask. But we laugh here tonight because you understand the absurdity of that thinking. But I'm telling you, that morning I could not make myself check the box. Because people are going to draw conclusions about me. And how can you do that without the backstory, without context, without the information? In fact, I had questions about the questions. I said, what do you mean morning? And I think it's a valid question because part of my problem is I think I know what they're asking. See, I think they're asking me if I'm that guy that's got a, you know, a bottle of vodka on the nightstand that wakes up at 4 a.m. with the shakes and the sweats and has to take a pull off of that just to fight that off, just to limp into the bathroom and maybe get into my day. And I've certainly done that a few times, but, you know, not so often I'm going to cop to it on this test. But there's another kind. You know, I said, what if, by the way, what if I'm out at a very nice establishment at 1 or 2 in the morning at last call? Is that morning drinking? And if I don't explain the difference to you, you'll think I'm poor, pitiful, you know, bottle on the nightstand guy rather than cool out at the club guy. Then they said, have you ever drank alone? I said, yes, but they left. Did you ever just go, whoa, where'd everybody go? You know, it was a party a while ago and all of a sudden it's me standing. But again, I think I know what they're asking me, right? I think they're asking me if I'm that guy that's got to go home, do what Chris talked about, drink in isolation, close the door, dim the lights, unplug the phone back then, now put it on silent or vibrate or turn it off. You know, drink in isolation, hide from the world. And I've done that a few times, but I'm not copping to it. But there's another kind of alone drinking that I had to do. I'm a guy that had to drink to go drinking. I see the heads nodding there. I got a drink to go drinking. Why is that? Why is that? Our book refers to alcohol as a social lubricant in one place. And man, I get that. You know, that's like oiling up, you know, and then I can move easily amongst you. But without that lubrication, I feel like I'm in fits and starts. I'm bumping into everything. Now, I don't look like that. I feel like that. See, I can't tell you, again, not understanding that relationship that the root of my problem is selfishness and self-centeredness, this hyper self-involvement with me, this hyper focus on what I feel like, on what I think you think. How does that look? How does that sound? Where do I fit in? I don't think I fit in, but how do I act like I fit in? How do I find some way not to get discovered in this group of people who, by the way, keep telling me I got it going on pretty good? Yet I know that, see, the wonderful line in our book, for me, one of the non-drinking parts of our book that let me know I was at the right place, my friend Ben and I talked about it, I think it was Ben and I today, or maybe it was that girl I took to treatment earlier this week. When the book says that the alcoholic, more than most, is an actor. He wears two faces. It's a stage character that he wants his fellows to see. He wants to be a man of certain reputation, but in his heart he knows he doesn't deserve it. And when I read that, I said, man, that's how I've lived my life. I desperately want to be a man of certain reputation. And I'm out to get it. But even when I get the accolade or the acknowledgement or the pat on the back, it leaves me empty because I know you're responding to the actor, because I know that I'm not showing up, that I am. And it's exhausting for me. It's exhausting to act that hard, to pretend like you got it together. And so that's when I needed to spend a lot of time alone. That's why I would end up in that isolation. It's too hard for me to be with you guys on a regular basis. You require too much of me. I don't know what it is you require, but it just feels like I gotta give you something. You know, I was 6 months sober, and sitting in a meeting on a Saturday afternoon, and I was loving being in AA at this point, but it's the first time that I realized Before the meeting, I heard this chatter going on. I'm sure it had been going on before. You guys hear the chatter in your home groups and when you're there. But I heard these people talking to each other, and it dawned on me, these folks are talking to each other between meetings. Some of these people have relationships. And I was just going to showing up and going home, showing up and going home. And I was loving that hour, but I had no connection to people because I was so hypersensitive, so uncomfortable, so insecure. And I can't let you catch me feeling that way. So somebody said, hey, we're all going to lunch. It was 11:30 Saturday meeting. They said, we're all going to lunch after the meeting. Everybody's invited. Who wants to go? Man, I desperately wanted to go. Desperately. And I got in my car after the meeting, and they identified the restaurant. I started over there, and I got about halfway there, and I turned off, and I went home. I couldn't go. And I did that 3 weeks in a row. I'd start, and I just couldn't go. And my fear was, what was stopping me was I was unwilling to have what I was afraid would be an awkward or embarrassing moment. I was afraid I would go in there and there would be six people sitting at a table for six. And I didn't know whether I'm supposed to ask somebody to scoot over. Do you recognize me outside the room? Did you mean me? I'm unwilling to say, hey guys. So I just didn't risk it. And I said, all I needed was a couple of guys to come over to me after the meeting and go, Steve, we've been talking, man. We really want you to go to lunch with us. And we're just arguing over who gets to sit with you. And if you did that, I would have gone and I would have owned the table. But I need you to remove every one of those barriers that are attached to my self-centered fear that stop me. My friend Lyle says that we would rather be dead than embarrassed. And I will tell you, many of us have suffered that fate. And I can't tell you how much that self-centered fear, that's the root of my trouble, controlled me before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and rears its head on a semi-regular basis today. But I'm aware of it. I see it. I am freer from it than I have ever been. I'm more aware of it when it shows up than I have ever been. But it's there because that's part of that human ego that is part of my problem. But see, I got that relationship with alcohol that doomed me, as Chris said. See, I think what I've just been talking about, and I'm putting this as from my point of view, so somebody else might view it differently. I'm talking about the unmanageability of my life. I'm talking about that hashtag, and my life had become unmanageable. And I don't view the unmanageability as the fact that I'm getting arrested, and I'm getting in trouble, and my wife's pissed at me, or whatever the external circumstances that were driven by my drinking cause. That's the chaos of my drinking. But this unmanageability is I couldn't manage to be okay. I couldn't manage to feel at peace and comfortable when I wasn't drinking. Now, I didn't always attach those two. I wasn't consciously going, I'm uncomfortable, I think I'll drink. And, you know, there were times, I did some angry drinking, I did some lonely drinking, I did some I'm afraid drinking on purpose. But lots of times I did not know why I was picking up a drink. And our book says we asked the guy why he went on that last drink. He says, hey, he may give any of 100 reasons. Once in a while he may tell the truth. We laugh at that line, right? Once in a while he may tell the truth because we are such consummate liars. But in fact, I think part of that, once in a while I may tell the truth because I'm saying so much stuff that every once in a while it's accurate whether I know it or not. It's the blind hog finding the acorn theory. I don't know where the truth is, but sometimes I tell it. You know? And so I'm just, that's that unmanageability that I didn't know had anything to do with the drinking problem I had. I didn't understand this alcoholism is this relationship with alcohol, can't seem to stay stopped, can't control how much I take. That's that first half of the first step, but that spiritual malady that's embedded in the second half of the first step is what the 12 steps seem to treat in me. That connecting with a power greater than myself which solves my problem. I'm going to jump ahead to make a point and then I'll give it back to Chris. Is because I spent all my time, as I said, trying to do better. Trying not to, you know, when our book says that the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that one day he will control and enjoy his drinking. Don't confuse that with the other line that says drink like a gentleman. We say if somebody can do a right about face and drink like a gentleman, we tip our cap to them. We don't have any freaking idea how a gentleman drinks. What I want to do is drink all I want and be perceived as a gentleman. What I want to do is control and enjoy my drinking, which means to me I want to drink and get everything alcohol does for me without suffering the pains of what it did to me. I want to get the good times that Chris talked about because I had them. I had them. But there were these bad side effects that over time with a progressive illness that I don't have a clue about. You know, when he talked about not being able to differentiate the true from the false. You know, I look back now and it says, our alcoholic life seen the only normal one? Have you ever, I look back and I go, how could that have ever looked normal to me? What must I have had to do to rationalize that behavior? What store, you know, I'll build a wing onto my house to accommodate my alcoholism. Rather than ask it to move out, just let me build you a guest room. And so I don't understand any of that stuff. But I didn't know why on a Tuesday afternoon, stone sober with a wife that loved me and a kid that loved me and a middle class life and a pretty good job and circumstantially things seeming like they were in place. Why do I feel the way that I feel? And again, I couldn't have told you how I feel. All I know is I feel different than I think you feel. I'm experiencing life differently than I think you're experiencing. Chuck Chamberlain said our single problem is that conscious separation from man and God. My single problem is I don't think I'm like anybody else. And Chuck C. would draw that circle with the little dot outside of it and say, that's me. And I will tell you, that's me. Except I don't want to get caught being the dot. I sneak into the circle and hope you don't figure out that, you know, that I've gotten past the velvet rope and I'm at the, you know, I'm in Studio 54, if you're old enough to remember Studio 54. Ben didn't even laugh back there, far too young. But, you know what I mean? I don't know any of that stuff. This alcoholism is baffling. When it says it's cunning, you know, powerful and baffling, it's baffling because I don't know I got it. I don't understand the components of alcoholism. I know I get drunk and get in trouble, but why do I feel the way I feel? And the 12 steps seem to feel that way. And so I spend all my time trying to stop, trying to do better. And I'm exerting all my will. And I get to AA and you guys say, Steve, that looks like the right, you know, it's reasonable to think that if you're doing something, the thing to do is to try to stop doing that thing. But you guys told me I didn't have the power. I was powerless. Powerless over that mental obsession and that physical allergy in particular. And you told me quit trying to solve that problem and connect with a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. And we get all the way back to the 10th step and reading on page 85 and 86 when it says that by now sanity will have returned. This relationship with alcohol is turned on its ear through the process of those 9 steps before the 10th step. Says by now sanity will have returned. Where alcohol is concerned, we'll react sanely and normally. And it says this new attitude toward liquor will be given us with no thought or effort on our part. It just comes. And I read that, I go, are you kidding me? I've been working my ass off in AA. I've been working steps. I've been giving guys rides I don't even like. I've been listening to a sponsor who's clearly confused about what's best for me. I've been working my butt off in AA. So what do you mean no thought or effort on my part? But what I've come to learn or believe for me is that there was no thought or effort on my part about gaining a new attitude toward liquor. The thought and effort that we put in Alcoholics Anonymous is about connecting with a power greater than myself, which will solve my problem. That new attitude toward liquor is a side effect of the spiritual awakening that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous offer me. So I want to connect through these steps. I want to connect with this power, and we're going to talk more about how much room I've got to find the power that I can conceive and identify with and embrace myself. And that does the work. My work is, you know, my work is to get there. And it says at the end of there is a solution. It says each of us, all of us, and certainly me and Chris this weekend, in our own language and from our own point of view, talks about how he established a relationship with God. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about how did I get a new attitude toward liquor. We're talking about how did I establish a relationship with God, and we don't spend a ton of time talking about God. We talk about how we establish the relationship. You know, I don't know. I'm here in East Dorset, and I don't know how the hell I got here, and I don't know very much where I am, but if I ask somebody here, tell me how to get to New York City. Ben and I got a rental car, so we're going to head to New York out here on Sunday. Somebody give me directions on how to get to New York. And you guys go, oh, Steve, you are going to love New York, man. And here are the restaurants you want to go to. Here are the Broadway shows you want to see. Here are the museums you want to go to. And I go, dude, I hear you, but I don't know how to get there. I didn't ask you to tell me what to do in New York. I want to know how to get to New York. And CNAA, what we share with each other is, how do I connect with this power? And then I get to have, if you tell me how to get to New York, I show up in New York and I have whatever relationship I can have. I go where I want to go. I have my own experience with New York. And here you let me have my own experience with that power greater than myself. And that's where we'll head during the rest of the weekend. Chris, take us.
Thanks, Steve.
You know, what I'm thinking a lot, the great examples that Steve is giving that are obviously examples of insanity that I relate to. You know, like I know exactly what he's talking about because very similar things have happened to me. So, you know, here's a question. Like, what did alcohol treat? You know, what did alcohol treat? Why did I drink it? Why was I drawn to the effects of alcohol? And I believe it's certainly in the beginning, if not all the way through, it was this toxic expression of selfishness and self-centeredness and self-involvement and worrying about everything in the world and just generally being uncomfortable with myself and my environment in a sober state. And alcohol treated that. So the book talks about alcohol being a symptom. It's certainly a big symptom. You know, it's a warning sign for alcoholism, drinking. But there's something underlying that. They describe it in many, many different ways, the spiritual malady. You know, we're restless, irritable, and discontented. We're prey to misery, depression, resentment, self-centered fear, you know, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. All these are ways to describe emotional and spiritual states. So I really have to come to an understanding of how deeply ill I am spiritually and how my emotional health is just, you know, in a really, really sad place. And as my alcoholism progressed and as I continue to treat, you know, the toxic self with alcohol, it got even worse. There was a progression in this self-consciousness. The egocentricness. They give it a million different descriptions in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. But I believe that that's what alcohol treated. So it would make sense that really the treatment for alcoholism can begin with the separation from alcohol, but it has to include the spiritual illness, the emotional illness that I'm experiencing. And the coolest thing in the world is a stock shyster from New York City that used to live right over there and a failing proctologist from Akron with big hands came up with you know, put together the, it was really Bill Wilson, he put together the architecture using the Oxford Group. He was really deep into New Thought. As he got sober and as he stayed sober, he read a lot And he studied a lot of Christian Science. He studied a lot of Catholicism. He learned from an Episcopal priest. He got really, really deep. He was drawn deeply into these spiritual studies. Because I believe intuitively he understood our recovery has got to start and has to completely include this spiritual capacity. We must become whole. There's a couple of lines in the book that have really resonated with me over the last couple of years. One of them is that we need to begin to understand that self had defeated us. Now think about that. Self had defeated us. We're us, right? Self is a series of belief systems. Self is our way of thinking. This self has gotten sick. Our belief about being the only one here and making decisions about how everything is going to impact us is what defeated us. You know, it doesn't say Chris Bourbon defeated you. It says self defeated you. And the many forms of the way self manifests, the way it calls self it, the way it manifests, it's amazing that they got so deep into what the real problem was. It's gonna take a personality change. It's gonna take a different way of thinking, of believing, a change in attitude. It's just gonna completely change the way I am. And they talk about in the book, after going through a series of steps to reduce this experience of self, that we were reborn. There's got to be a rebirth. And all this stuff is in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's talking about the wholesale miracle that happened when a whole bunch of alcoholics applied these principles and applied these steps. A wholesale miracle happened, and there's been an enormous amount of recovery. So when I see after the dash in step one, my life is unmanageable. Me managing it is, number one, it's really a bad idea. But it's more of an internal condition. If you drank, let's say you're not alcoholic and you drank like I did, there's plenty of alcoholics that get drunk out of their mind and cause a lot of trouble. You know, that's not really what they're talking about in alcoholism. They're talking about us being spiritually ill. So a recovery program has got to include something that will help the spirit recover. And it's funny, in step 12, they talk about the awakening of the spirit. And so, you know, Steve and I are going to be here this weekend. We're going to try to share from our own experience some of the things we've done, some of the experiences we've had, some of the lessons we've learned, and tell some of these stories. But, you know, I'll tell you one story about this self, from very, very early on. I'll tell you one story, and it's something that ingrained itself into my memory when I was 5 years old. All right, I'm 5 years old, and my mother comes into the room, and she says, Chris, today's your first day of kindergarten. Get yourself ready. And I'd heard about this kindergarten stuff, you know, wasn't too keen on it, you know, but some of the other kids talked about it, and I knew that, you know, she was bigger than me. So I went, and I started to get ready, and I got my stuff. We went out to a Packard Clipper. This is how long ago it was. The 1956, 57 Packard Clipper. And she drove me across town, And I remember her opening the door and pointing down at the classroom and saying, there's the classroom. I'll come back later today and I'll pick you up. See you later. And she drove away. Now I'm 5 years old and I'm standing up on this hill and I'm looking down, and this is what really screwed me up. All the kids were already friends and they were already having fun. And they were playing kickball and tag. And I'm standing up on the hill looking down, and an overwhelming anxiety went over me. So, you know, self-centered fear on steroids. I'm thinking, who the hell came up with this kindergarten thing? This is not gonna work for me, you know? I'm gonna run home and, you know, tell them that this just, but I knew I couldn't run home. There would have been a real big to-do. So what I had to do was really, I had to suck it up and act as if I wasn't totally freaking out, and I had to walk down and I had to join that kindergarten class. Now, you know what? Here's the thing. You know what would have treated that condition? You know what would have made everything better? A half a pint of vodka. The problem was they weren't serving 5-year-olds. That was the problem, because if I would have had a half a pint of vodka, I'd have been the kindergarten kid. You'd have been lucky to have me on your team, you know? You'd have been lucky to pick. So what alcohol did was alcohol shifted. So on one side of the scale is selfishness and self-consciousness and self-centeredness and anxiety. What alcohol did was throw me all the way to the other side of the spectrum, where I'm wild, with abandon, you know, no fear, doing crazy, reckless, you know, stupid stuff. And that alcohol was valuable to me, but I can't use it anymore. It's killing me. So I've got to find a way to get somewhere to the center. And Steve said it. It's in a relationship with the divine. It's in the consciousness of the presence of God. The conscious contact with God is really the thing that's gonna treat that stuff. But I don't know how to get there. You know, I can read an Alan Watts book or a C.S. Lewis book. I'm not gonna cut it. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I find the solution for this stuff. It's remarkable. It's remarkable. It's remarkable to me.
I gotta tell you, Chris told the story about going to school, and I'd heard the story about the dad, who goes in and is knocking on his son's door saying, "You've got to get up. It's time to go to school. You got to get up. It's time to go to school." And the son goes, "Dad, I don't want to go." Said, the kids are mean and make fun of me and pick on me all day. And he goes, "Yeah, but you're 42 and you're the teacher. You've got to go." And I'm still subject to that, right? I can still be that. No, I don't want to go. No, I don't want to go show up for life in the way that it looks like everybody else is. I tell you what, I tend to say things when they show up, so they'll be out of context and without a number on them this weekend. But I never know. That feeling of being different, that feeling of getting ready to walk into a door. You know, walk through a door into a room, to a social situation or a work situation or a family situation, and steel myself up to then be ready to show up, right? But I'm having to get myself together. Have you ever walked up, and I know I won't make you, it's rhetorical, you don't have to answer, but, I've gone places where I wasn't sure what was supposed to happen, right? I'm going, might be a work situation, a lot of people milling around, might be something else, and I don't quite know my way around yet. So have you ever pretended to be on your phone? Yeah. That way, because it looks like I'm doing something. I don't look like that dumbass who doesn't know where to go. So I'll act like I'm talking to somebody and try to figure this out. And you know, metaphorically, I have done some version of that in my life a lot. And what has been this freedom from the bondage of self and is at least a lessening of the bonds, you know, that is so important. What happens for me here, you know, Ben and I were talking in the car today, and I keep calling Ben because I want you guys to talk to him this weekend. Ben, raise your hand. There you go. Because he's all the way in the back row, right? He's all there. But see, we're talking coming over here, right? And what happens in AA is I show up here with one problem and you solve another. Right? I show up here with a problem with alcohol and then people start saying, well, alcohol's not my problem. And you know, I don't argue with that. What I'll tell you is when I drink, I'm a problem. My sponsor said, you know, when the book says that the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning, a much greater demonstration of these principles lies before us in our respective homes, affairs, and occupations. And my sponsor said early on said that's true, Steve-O. He said, but that not drinking part's real important. And, cause I don't seem to be able to benefit from anything else Alcoholics Anonymous has for me while I'm drinking. Because I believe, I don't know if this is true of the non-alcoholic, but I believe it blocks me off from you and from God. It is synthetic. It is man-made. It gives me some relief, but it's an illusion. It's like pain medication. It hasn't treated the problem. It has tricked me into thinking the pain is not there. And, so there's also this story I love. I want to tell it because I'll forget if I don't, that there was this, executive in a Fortune 500 company, and by all accounts a great guy, a little bit like Fred in the book, and by all accounts a great producer in the company, well liked by everybody. He had one real failing. It seemed that every week when he went to give his report to the CEO of the company, he would wet himself. And he wore khaki, so it was a bad look. And he was horribly embarrassed by that, as is understandable. And the CEO was a kind and compassionate man, and he said, you know, I'm going to connect you with our company psychiatrist to help you with that. He's grateful. He goes off and comes back the next week, goes in to deliver his report, sure enough, wets himself. And the CEO goes, well, I'm sorry you didn't get a chance to see the psychiatrist. And he said, no, I saw him. Well, I'm sorry he couldn't help you with your problem. He went, no, we're good. He helped me. He goes, dude, you just pissed yourself, you know? And he said, yeah, but I'm no longer embarrassed about it. So what problem's getting solved here, right? I show up with this drinking problem, and this hyper-self-centeredness is what begins to be treated. What happens with these 12 steps is it makes the alcohol unnecessary. In fact, it makes it a burden. It takes away what you've given me. See, I'm not here tonight out of desperation. And if you're new, I want you to understand, I don't think there's too many new people here, but that's not, I'm absolutely capable of getting drunk again. I suffer no illusions about that, but I'm not here out of fear of getting drunk. I'm here out of, because I love the life I have today. Because I've been given this freedom. And I don't embrace it all the time. I don't access it all the time because that ego will show back up. That ego only has bad news for a guy like me. That ego just says, you're not enough. There's not enough time. There's not enough stuff for you. They don't, you know. I'm at a meeting one night and I was about, 4 or 5 years sober. It's when I was, Sean, living in Richmond, Virginia. And I spoke about as long as I've spoken tonight. And it was not a speaker meeting. Got home. My sponsor had been there. I called my sponsor, Joe. You asked some folks about Joe Sullivan, and Joe's passed away now. But I asked Joe. I said, Joe, did I sound self-righteous in that meeting tonight? And he said, oh, Steve, you're still asking all the wrong questions. He said, because the question isn't, did you sound self-righteous? The question is, were you self-righteous? He said, but see, you don't care if you were self-righteous or not. You're afraid they think you're self-righteous. You're afraid they're driving home going, man, that Steve's a self-righteous son. He says, you're not worried about the defect of character. You're worried about what the defect looks like on you. And he said, here's the news, Steve. He says, you're not who you think you are. And you're not who they think you are. And you're especially not who you think they think you are. And I'm going to tell you, that struck me, and from that day till this, I've become high. It's not like I'm free of that, but I'm aware of the fact of how often I am impacted by what I think you think. How will this look? How will this sound? How will this play? And sometimes, you know, it can be a whole host of things. We say, and then we get to saying stuff around here that I don't understand. I need other people to help me understand what it means. And you guys started saying what other people think of you is none of your business. And I thought that meant that I shouldn't care what anybody thinks about me. I care. I've sat up here tonight. I hope you like me. I'd love to be liked and respected and appreciated and all of these things. But what you teach me in AA is while it's okay to kind of want those things, I can't let that dictate my behavior. That what I'm supposed to do is embrace these 12 steps and make principle-driven decisions, and the conclusions you draw about me are out of my hands. Because I don't know what my recovery looks like to somebody else. But I do know that if I keep trying to please individuals here, chase you around, you know, we've all heard the guy that's gives the talk at a conference somewhere, and you know, 99 people pat you on the back and one person picks a bone with you, and I chase that guy around the rest of the weekend trying to convert him. Rushing by the people who appreciate me. Rushing by, how many times do I, you know, so I'm just trying to be free of that, and I don't try, like Chris said, I don't try through force of will. I don't try. Now I got about 30 or 40 books at home, read about 30, 35 pages in. You've got some of them. I mean, the book jacket looked like it had the answer. And I said, I'll read this, and there's going to be something on a page that's going to make the difference. Or I'm going to go listen to Steve and Chris tonight, and that's going to make the difference. I'm going to hear something, read something, see something that's going to make the difference. And it does. What we do is hear things that maybe help us change a perspective or a point of view that then free me up to go take the actions necessary. What we got to do is take the information and put it into application to bring about the transformation. Nothing happens when, if you've liked anything we've said tonight, it won't last till you get back over to the house. We're like a bad Chinese meal. I mean, you're going to be spiritually hungry in an hour. But maybe between us, we will identify some things we can do. We can take these actions. We can reach out to other people. We can sponsor guys. We can be sponsored. At 32 years sober, I'm finding it hard to be sponsored. And I don't mean somebody to tell me when to turn left and right and everything, but I mean I gotta get on record. You know, when you get sober a little while, and there's some people here sober a little while, and all of a sudden there's some problems we're unwilling to have out loud. I can't have that. You kidding? They might not invite me back up to the Wilson house if I talk about this. I might lose my, you know, I know there's some old enough timers here that you got a seat at your home group. You got your seat at the home group. They might take my seat away. You know, I might lose my standing. You want to know the most dangerous thing a guy like me does in AA is get involved in image management in AA. What a bunch of losers to try to impress, right? We all had to burn our lives down to get here, and all of a sudden, I start worrying about, you know, because my first year sober, man, I'll tell you anything. I made stuff up. But then after a while, I'll start protecting myself in AA. Now I begin to think I got a particular role to play in AA. And you ever gone to a meeting and hope somebody else brings up your topic? I want to hear about it. I just don't want them to know I'm the one with that problem. Man, I think the best thing we do, what I've discovered, I'm not always up to the task, but what I've discovered and what I hope we continue to do this weekend, is that when we talk about feeling disconnected, that conscious separation between man and God, it is the secret that separates me. It is that thing. There's a difference between private and secret. And those things that I'm afraid to let you see, what I've discovered is that when I do let you see it, that turns out to be what we have in common. And I don't mean a particular behavior necessarily, but that underlying feeling. We are all carrying that underlying feeling. We are, as our book says, we are much more brothers in our defects than in our virtues. But we only want to show the best side of us. And I mean, we want to do better, act better, be better. I get that. But one-on-one, when we're talking with each other, when we're in those, we have those confidants, it's taking that curtain down and letting people know, I get to tell you when I'm scared to death. I get to tell you when I told a lie at work. And I only do it when it's absolutely necessary. You know, I only lie when the truth couldn't possibly work. And that's the manifestation of self. That's when this shows up and we go, AA, this AA, because we can talk some AA. And believe it when we're saying it. But then case by case, am I up to it when it shows up? When our book says all these affairs. And with the, so when I get the real life in real time opportunity, do I answer the bell? And I thank God that's, you know, we are given an out right in how it works so we don't panic. You know, after we read those steps, it says, whoa, don't panic, kid. We're not saints. We come nowhere near perfect adherence to these principles. What's the point? Jesus, if I can't, well, the point is we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. Let's spend the rest of this weekend asking ourselves, wherever we are in our recovery journey, however long we've been here, how little bit of time, am I willing to grow along spiritual lines still? Or if I hit a spot where I'm ready to coast and not press myself, if I hit a spot where now I'm going to start keeping some stuff over behind the corner. If I hit a spot where I think I can stay sober, but that bond, those bonds of self begin to tighten up around me. I believe that to tell you the truth, I've said about three things tonight I needed to hear. Now, usually they say you don't learn anything when you're talking. I hear shit all the time. Pardon me. That I go, whoa, I might ought to try that. And, that was good. That might actually work. And but you know, it becomes a challenge. And I think one of the reasons, to be honest, that maybe God has put me sitting up here sometimes is because if I was just a third row AA member, I'm a coaster by nature. I'm just a C student by nature. I want to do just good enough not to draw attention for doing bad and just well enough not to have too many expectations put on me. But you guys invite me into the conversation in a bigger way. When you invite me here, you give me that chance to learn about me while I'm talking to you. And then when you talk about yourselves, it gives me that chance to also then take what you share with me. And I hope we continue to do that the rest of the weekend. Chris. Chris says I wanted to, and he thought I wouldn't.
I'm enjoying every bit of it. One of the first lessons I got on what really was my problem, I was about, I don't know, I was about 9 months sober and my sponsor showed up at my house. Now this was really weird. He'd never shown up unannounced before. You know, I thought there might be an issue. And he comes into the house and he goes upstairs. And I've always been a big reader. I've always read millions of books. And the first thing he does is, you know, he's looking over my bookshelves and he sees all the self-help books, right? You know, The Joy of Resentment, you know, When Friends Through Intimidation, you know. I mean, every, but you know, Humility and Beyond. I mean, every single self-help book that ever could exist. And he's going, Chris, you got a lot of self-help books here. And I'm like, yeah, Phil, yeah. And he goes, could I ask you a question? I go, sure. He goes, where's your Help Others books? And I go, I'm unfamiliar with that category, Phil. You know, self can't fix it. How selfish is having 75 self-help books? You know, so that was one of the lessons, like, There's gotta be action. This is a program of action. I love the challenge that Steve gave all of us. Are we willing to stay enthusiastic about this thing? are we willing to continue to go deeper, let's mine this gold mine we've found, you know, one more level down. Let's see what we can do. Let's see what we can do this weekend about recommitting to some action. Because it's the action, it's not the thinking, it's the action that really, really has helped me. And, I think we're done for tonight, and you got any final thoughts?
In the parking lot.
Okay. Alright, he's got some thoughts in the parking lot. Alright.
Thank you, Chris and Steve. It's been awesome listening to you. Housekeeping, we need to move all the audio equipment, and the audio guys are going to take care of that. We got an audio team set up, and we need to move these two pieces of stage over to the meeting house, and we need to set up the meeting house for tomorrow morning's meeting. Just a reminder, breakfast is from 7:30 to 8:30, meeting at 8:45 in the meeting room. Try to park your cars down in the parking lot down there and try to leave the area open in front of the church open. Or if you have to park down there, park as far down on the railroad side as possible. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow morning.